The following recording was produced by Christ Redeemer Church of Hanover, New Hampshire. The speaker is Doug Cooper. You may find more information on the church and its various resources on the web at www.christredeemerchurch.org.
Good morning, everyone. If you guys could please turn to page 6 in your bulletins, that's going to be the word of the day today. James 1, 2-18. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Such a person is double-minded and unstable in all they do. Believers in humble circumstances ought to take pride in their high position, but the rich should take pride in their humiliation, since they will pass away like a wild flower. For the sun rises with scorching heat and withers the plant. Its blossom falls, and its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich will fade away, even while they go about their business. Blessed is the one who perseveres under trial, because, having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him. When tempted, no one should say, "God is tempting me," for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. Then, after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Don't be deceived, my dear brothers and sisters. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created. This ends the reading of God's word.
Who do we think that God is? Who do we believe God to be? And you may think that you've got a sure, ready answer to that question, but what James seems to be implying here in this passage that was just read for us is that the time, if you're going to designate a time to really answer that question, the time to most accurately answer that question is when you're being tested. If you want to know who you really believe God to be, then answer that question when you're being tried by troubles, when you're being tried by temptations. Because in the mind of James, these are what you might call, and I'm speaking about troubles and temptations, these are what you might call revealers. They have a way of revealing what's already there, almost like a truth serum, maybe. These are litmus tests, you could say. They're like barometers. They're like thermometers. They take our temperature. In other words, another way of saying this, belief equals behavior. What you believe to be true about God will shake out in how you respond in these sorts of situations. And in that way, troubles and temptations help us to answer this question that I posed. Who do you believe God to be? Who do you perceive, is maybe a better way of putting it. Who do you perceive God to be? Now, we're going to get into this, but why does James highlight this for us? Why does he highlight this for us? And I've almost answered that question, but here's a spoiler alert for you. It isn't simply that James likes to point out uncomfortable, unnerving sorts of things. This is an uncomfortable question, I think. I'm not saying that it isn't uncomfortable. I'm not saying that it isn't unnerving. It is. Questions that reveal and uncover things in our lives tend to be kind of uncomfortable, tend to be kind of unnerving. In fact, if this question doesn't make us uncomfortable, if it doesn't make you uncomfortable and a little unnerved, you may have bigger problems, bigger questions to be asking yourself. But here's the spoiler alert, and here's the big idea that we're after this morning. James isn't merely interested in making us uncomfortable. Like a good pastor, what he's really interested in is leading us towards a clearer and truer understanding of who God really is. And he believes that as we get that understanding, as we nurture that understanding, as we foster it in our own lives, that it will totally transform the ways in which we face both troubles and temptations. It will produce in us, coming around to this theme again, it will produce in us a faith that works. It will produce in us a living faith. And in his efforts to do that, he touches on three aspects of faith in these verses that we're going to look at. He describes what I'm going to call tested faith. He describes what I'm going to call true faith. And he describes tough faith. And some of these things we'll need more explanation when we get to them. But I'll just say that one more time. Tested faith, true faith, in tough faith. So beginning with tested faith. Now, last week, we looked at how troubles function in our lives, in our walk of faith. This week, we're primarily looking at how temptations tend to function in our lives. So I had this whole passage printed. I had Ben read the whole passage. But the primary place that we're looking at is verses 12 through 18. And in case you weren't with us last week, at the time, I pointed out that when this was written, this idea of being tested was a bit different from the ways that we might tend to think about what it means to be tested. What James has in mind here is being tested in the same ways that metal is tested, or tempered is another way that you might put that, as it's placed in the fire, as it's exposed to extreme heat, the metal is then refined, okay, in the hands of the smelter. The smelter is working the metal in order that it might become all the more pure, all the more precious, all the more strong, all the more durable as a result. And both troubles and temptations hold the potential of functioning in our lives in that same sort of a way. They both bring, if you think about it, they both bring heat into our lives, do they not? And that heat can result in us being refined in very particular sorts of ways. And this does seem to be what James has in mind. In fact, if you look back at verse 12 in your bulletins, if you've got them open, many scholars see verse 12 as what you might call a hinge verse. Okay, so you've got verses 2 through 11, which is what we primarily looked at last week. You've got verses 13 through 18. And verse 12 is a verse that connects these two. It's got a connective tissue that attaches one half to the other. They're connected. Let me just read verse 12 for you. Blessed is the one who perseveres under trial, because having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him. And then verse 13 reads, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. And interestingly enough, the word trial that's used in verse 12, which is much of the language that we got in verses 2 through 11, and the word tempted that's used there in verse 13 are actually the very same word in the Greek. They both essentially mean a test of a particular kind. However, if you're thinking with me, this does get a bit tricky when we come to this idea of temptation, because troubles and temptations are different things, right? They're different. In many ways, however, it is a bit of a package deal. In other words, troubles will often, if when you get troubles coming into your life, troubles will often tempt us to respond in ways that will only lead to more trouble for us. You know, troubles can tempt us to fly off the handle. Troubles can tempt us to indulge in various forms of escapism, right? And then on the flip side of that, if you want to flip that around a little bit, temptations are troublesome things, aren't they? temptations can get us into a lot of trouble. However, that being said, troubles and temptations are two very different things. Have I got you guys confused yet? Clear as mud, right? Okay. But no, really though, they're different. They're different. A trouble or a trial, as James puts it, is about the external realities that come into our lives and test us. And they may include some of the sorts of things that the folks that James is writing to right here are actually undergoing and enduring. It might include daunting, uncertain situations. It might include financial struggles, different forms of suffering, suffering at the hands of other people, many things that may be completely and totally out of our control, out of our hands, but that come into our life all the same, external realities. Temptations, on the other hand, have less to do with external realities and more to do with internal realities. Notice how James puts it beginning in verse 13. And as we're rereading this, notice all of the references to temptation that are included here. James writes, "When tempted, no one should say, 'God is tempting me,' for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone, but each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire." So there's that internal reality that I was just talking about a second ago. Each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. Then, after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it's full grown, gives birth to death. So James is talking about some kind of deadly collision between our external reality and our internal reality. In fact, rather than a collision, he uses a different metaphor, right? He uses the metaphor of procreation. So he describes a kind of marriage that takes place between two things that don't belong together, but that give birth, and they give birth to sin. And as it grows up, it gives birth to death. But it begins internally. It begins in our hearts. This past Monday, of course, I'm sure you all know, is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And each year is a family. Our family tries to set aside a bit of time to consider the life of Martin Luther King Jr. and to learn from him, to learn from the events of the civil rights movement. And this year, what we did is, I've got a book, got it at my transfer station. Dumps are great, okay? I got a book that has a bunch of his sermons in it. And so we read through one of his sermons that was preached back in 1957, so going back a ways, a sermon entitled "Love Your Enemies," based on the teaching of Jesus from the Gospel of Matthew. And as I thought about this collision of our external realities and our internal realities, I thought back to some of the things that he'd said in the sermon. So here's a bit of it that may be helpful to us. And what he's doing in this message is he's trying to answer the question, how do we go about loving our enemies? And obviously, I don't need to tell you this, you know, we're talking about living faith, like real faith, faith that engages, faith that responds, that he was preaching to a people who this was significantly relevant to them, what he was talking about. But enough of my words. Let me read his. He started in, "Now let me hasten to say, that Jesus was very serious when he gave this command to love our enemies. He wasn't playing. He realized that it's hard to love your enemies. He realized that it's difficult to love those persons who seek to defeat you, those persons who say evil things about you. He realized that it was painfully hard, pressingly hard, but he wasn't playing," he says. In other words, you know, him speaking to this crowd, because of our external situation, there's a huge temptation here that we need to acknowledge. There's a huge temptation here. There's a temptation towards hate and all that flows from that, all that hate gives birth, sin and death. there's a very difficult test that we have got before us, is what he was telling these people. And he does this great job of capturing the internal struggle on this. Okay, he goes on and he says this: how do you go about loving your enemies? I think the first thing is this: in order to love your enemies, you must begin by analyzing self. And I'm sure that seems strange to you, that I start out telling you this morning that you love your enemies by beginning with a look at self. But it seems to me that that is the first and foremost way to come to an adequate discovery of the how of this situation. And then he goes on, he says this: I've said to you on many occasions that each of us is something of a schizophrenic personality. This is really profound, what I think he's saying here. We're split up and divided against ourselves. And there is something of a civil war going on within all of our lives. There is a recalcitrant south of our soul revolting against the north of our soul. And there is this continual struggle within the very structure of every individual life. There is something within all of us that causes us to cry out with Ovid, the Latin poet, "I see and approve the better things of life, but the evil things I do." There's something within all of us that causes us to cry out with Plato that the human personality is like a charioteer with two headstrong horses, each wanting to go in different directions. There is something within each of us that causes us to cry out with Goethe, there is enough stuff in me to make both a gentleman and a rogue. There is something within each of us that causes us to cry out with the Apostle Paul, "I see and approve the better things of life, but the evil things I do." You can see the point he's making. He's really trying to make a strong point here. And then get this, he says, so somehow the isness of our present nature, like what is, you know, like what actually is happening within us, Somehow the isness of our present nature is out of harmony with the external oughtness that forever confronts us. In other words, something's busted up inside of us, right? Something's busted up inside of us. And what I believe he was saying was that if we want to love our enemies, we need to, at the very least, we need to begin by seeing that in so many ways, we are our own worst enemies. What lurks within the heart of my enemy is the very same thing that lurks within my own heart, is what I think he was trying to teach these people. And what Martin Luther King is capturing so well here, I think, is the very same thing that James is highlighting for us, that what we do and that what we ought to do are terribly out of sync. They're completely out of harmony. That we are, you might say, spiritually schizophrenic. That when temptation comes and we are tested by temptation, the quality or the condition of our natural faith or our natural disposition is revealed. We get to see it. It shows itself. And what we find is that our faith is inherently broken, okay? That left to ourselves, and I really believe this is going to come up over and over again, that this is something that James is really zeroing in on through this whole letter, that left to ourselves, we're double-minded. Left to ourselves, we're double-hearted. We're divided. And what we desperately need is what I'm calling a true faith. We need a true faith. Or to stick with what I've been saying in these last few weeks, we need a living faith. Okay, a faith that works, even in the face of temptation, even in the face of troubles, true faith. So what is that? And how do we get it? What is this true faith? So again, we considered tested faith, now true faith. And what I mean by true faith is not so much a faith that believes more, like, and sins less. Although those are not bad things, of course, I'm not saying that, but I don't think that that's at the heart of what James is writing about here. Rather than that, I think he's trying to foster a faith among these believers who are going through a really hard time that has a very clear understanding of the object of the faith, of their faith. A really clear sight of the one who they're setting their faith upon, a true understanding of who God really is. Again, he wants them to have real faith, a living faith, and therefore his main concern, his first concern, is that they understand who God truly is. And if you stop to think about it, this concern of his is at the very heart of our own internal struggles. It's at the very heart, you know, this is the problem that is at the heart of our struggle with temptation and with sin. Think of the genesis of this for a moment, the beginning, right? Think of the genesis of this. Where did this all get started? Jerry Bridges made this point so well. He said, the very first temptation in the history of mankind, he's taken us back. Where did this temptation stuff get started? We need to go back. The very first temptation in the history of mankind was the temptation to be discontent. And he says, that is exactly what discontentment is, a questioning of the goodness of God. Have you ever defined discontentment that way? A questioning of the goodness of God. What did the serpent tell Eve in the garden? What did he say? He said, hey, I'm paraphrasing, by the way. Hey, if you want to be wise, Eve, if you want to be wise like God, if you want to understand both good and evil like him, if you want wisdom, eat the fruit. Eat the fruit. And here's why. Because he won't give it to you. He won't give you that wisdom. He's withholding good things from you, Eve. He's not generous. He's stingy. And I just cannot help but hearing in the words of James in verse 5, in your bulletins there, that this is what James has got on his mind when he writes this in verse 5. In verse 5, he says, if any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Such a person is double-minded and unstable in all they do. In other words, Eve, that's the situation she was in. She was divided. She was trying to walk in two different directions at the same time. She lost sight of who God truly was. Isn't that what happened? She lost sight of who he is. She forgot how outrageously generous he was. That if she wanted true wisdom, all she needed to do was ask, and he would freely give to her. And James is continuing very clearly to make this point, even as we press on into these latter verses on our page, verses 13 through 18. So, I mean, look at him with me. What's the main point that James is actually making here? What's he really after? We tend to get hung up on his description of the operation of sin in our lives, how it works, you know, this sequence that he describes. And in so doing, we can really get detached from the main point that he's trying to make. And it's super important that we, you know, hone in on this sequence that he's talking about. It's not unimportant. I'm not saying that. But we have got to see it in light of the main point that he's actually making. So what's his main point? So listen for it as I read again. I'm starting at verse 13. When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. And then we get that sequence, that description of the operation of sin in our lives. And then if you go just beyond that, you get verse 16. Don't be deceived, my dear brothers and sisters. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. Other verse translations say there's no variation with him. He doesn't change. He does not change like shifting shadows. He isn't double-minded. He isn't unstable in his ways. And then verse 18, he chose to give us birth through the word of truth that we might be kind of first fruits of all he created. So what's his main point? What is his actual main concern here? And guess what? It's not us. It's not apart from us. That's not what I'm saying. But it's not singularly, centrally us. It's God. His main concern is the truth about who God really is and our perception of who God truly is. That he's not a stingy God. He's not shifty. He's not shady. Okay? Rather than that, he's a generous father, is what James is telling us. That he's the father of lights that gives good gifts to his children. That he's the God who desires to give us new birth. Verse 18, I'm mentioning there. That he desires to give us new birth through the word of truth. In other words, through the gospel, through the sacrificial love of his son, through Christ. Why, we should ask. Verse 18, so that we might become a kind of first fruits of all that he's created. What does that mean? That we might be the best of the harvest. That we might be the cream of the crop. That we might be the apple of his very eye. That's how fathers look at newborn babies, right? That's what he's talking about, right? Giving us birth. You see, James gets us. He understands us. It's really helpful. He understands what goes through our hearts and through our minds when we're faced with troubles and when we're faced with temptations of many kinds. He understands that we say things like this: will he really take care of me? Does he really care? If he really cared, he would never have allowed this set of circumstances to come about in the first place. If he really cares, I wouldn't need to struggle with this temptation. I wouldn't need to battle with this crippling sin in my life. I wouldn't need to be humiliated in this way yet again. If he really cared, he's just set me up for the fall. He's playing games with me. This isn't fair. James understands that this is where our minds can go. This is where our hearts can go when we're faced with real troubles in our lives, when we're faced with real temptations, when we're really in the battle of sin. And James is saying to us, James is speaking into that narrative, that interior narrative that we've got, and he's saying, wrong. 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 You got it all wrong, okay? You aren't seeing clearly. Your vision is all kinds of screwed up. Let me help you see things right, is what James is saying. Let me help you see. In a sense, you could say that James here is like an ophthalmologist, okay? And as an eye doctor, he's got a diagnosis for us, and he's got a prescription for us. We've got to see the inherent struggle that we're all up against, that we all struggle, all of the struggle, to hold on to a clear, accurate view of this God. There's the diagnosis, all right? And that we need to begin to see God for who he truly is. That's the prescription. And he's looking to provide us with some corrective lenses. This is what he's giving us is a prescription of proclamation. He's telling it like it is, kind of like Martin Luther King Jr. was. Jesus said that, and he wasn't playing. You know, he's giving it to us straight. He's telling us the truth about God. He tells us that, what does he tell us? He tells us that he's a father to us. He's the father of heavenly lights. You know, all good gifts come from his hands. As Charles Spurgeon put it, if he be a father, let me note his commands. Just notice the motivational drive here in what he's saying. If he be a father, let me note his commands and let me reverentially obey. If he has said, do this, let me do it. Not because I dread him. Not because I see him as a God who is against me at every corner. But because I love him. Because I see him. Is my father. And me as his son. Is his daughter. And if he forbids me to do anything, let me avoid it. Or here's another one. You guys have heard me read this one several times. You'll hear it many times more because I find this so helpful. This is from J.I. Packer. He says, if you want to judge how well a person understands Christianity, find out how much he makes of the thought of being God's child and having God as his father. If this is not the thought that prompts and controls his worship and prayers and his whole outlook on life, and in that I would say the ways in which we respond to troubles and temptations, it means that he does not understand Christianity very well at all. this perspective, this way of seeing things, makes all the difference in the ways in which we see and respond to troubles and temptations. Why? Because love begets love. Strength and a will to overcome temptation in sin is the result of us having a clear vision of Christ. It doesn't come from us obsessing about our sin. That's not where it comes from. We have to see our sin through the lens, the corrective lens of the gospel, okay, and confront it from that vantage point. This made me think, kind of sticking with my vision metaphor here. How many of you are familiar with macular degeneration? You guys know about that? It's something that I've had a lot of experience working with in my work in occupational therapy. In case you don't know what it is, it's a disease that affects your central vision of your retina. It allows you to continue to see peripherally. So your peripheral vision stays maintained, but your central vision begins to cloud and fade, okay? And which is a terrible condition for many reasons. Peripheral vision, let's just think about this for a second. Peripheral vision is wonderful, okay? It's hugely important. If you don't believe me that our peripheral vision is really important, something that we tend to take for granted, but go ahead and put on some blinders, like, you know, those horse racing blinders. Put on a pair of those and just see how the day goes. It'll be maddening to you. So it's very important. However, if you lose your central vision, you may as well be blind. And here's why. If you really want to look at something, if you really want to see something clearly, you need to look straight at it. Okay, I'm being obvious, I know. You need to have that direct central vision so that you can focus on something and truly concentrate on the central thing that's before you. And you can't use peripheral vision to do that. You can't use your peripheral vision to really get a good, solid look at something. And so without your central vision, you're really in trouble. People with severe macular degeneration, they can't read books anymore. They can't drive anymore. They can't really get a good close look at their loved ones anymore. If we're only seeing our sin from a peripheral view, we will only ever address our sin in very peripheral sorts of ways. We'll fight it, perhaps. We might even have some success at it, but we'll be fighting it in the wrong sorts of ways. We'll be fighting it from a position of guilt. We'll be fighting it from a position of shame. We'll be fighting it from a position of fear. So, how should we fight it? What is the position that we need to be fighting it from? So, we looked at a tested faith. We looked at a true faith. Now let's look at a tough faith. That's what true faith, and by it I'm talking about this clear vision, should give us is a tough faith. And let me just say, I was kind of wrestling with this idea of naming it. Obviously, I'm using the T's and the F's here, right? Okay. I thought about calling it a tempered faith because it goes along with this idea of working with metallurgy. That the work of tempering when it comes to metal is to make something in such a way, a metal in such a way that it's lasting, that it can persevere, that it can endure. It doesn't always go the same way, though. In some cases, they heat it up really slowly to make the metal very hard, like a tool. In other cases, they'll heat it quickly to give that metal some kind of like elasticity, like a spring or something like that. But the goal is the same. Can look different in different situations. And God's, I think, trying to work in our ways in both of these different kinds of ways. But the idea is perseverance, endurance, okay? Let me just tease this out for you, for us. The reason that we need this kind of tempered faith. Anybody here ever tried paddleboarding? I'm looking out. I'm looking for the bakers. I don't see the bakers here this morning. They would have gotten a kick out of this. Anybody ever tried paddleboarding? Okay. So I had seen a lot of paddleboarding in my days. I'd watched others doing it. It looked simple enough to me. It almost looked, you watch people paddleboarding, they almost look relaxed out there, you know? So it's just like, oh, that looks nice. That looks relaxing. And here's the thing. I'm a boarder. All right. I've been a boarder my whole life. I grew up on a skateboard, started skateboarding as a young kid. If you ever, there were whole years of my life where if you ever saw me, I either had a board under my feet or under my arm or under my backside. I always had a skateboard. I'm a boarder. You know how they refer to like a one woman man? I'm a one plank man. All right. I'm not like the skiers out there. I can see them whispering right now. I'm not like the skiers out there. I'm a one plank guy. All right. I've done snowboarding. I still skateboard from time to time. So that being said, I'd like to think the point I'm trying to make here. I'd like to think that I've got a good sense of balance on a single board. So we in the summertime, in case you're unfamiliar, we as a church. Bi-weekly, we have a gathering at the beach at Sunapee just to hang out, have dinner together, and the bakers, who are often with us, showed up one of those Sunday evenings, brought their paddle boards with them, and so I was just like, here we go. Okay, this is my chance. Time to add one more plank to my arsenal of single planks that I've mastered. And I had one problem, however. I didn't have a bathing suit. But not to worry, you know, not like I'm going to fall or something like that, because I've got this. I'm a one-plank guy. So, but wouldn't you know it, I did not return to the shore in the same manner in which I left the shore. I came back heavier, all right? I came back a little bit soggy and with my tail between my legs as well. Here's why. Because regardless of how good your balance may be, regardless of how much experience you may have, it's hard to stand on shaky ground. It's hard to remain stable and steady and sturdy when you have got a weak foundation beneath your feet, right? But James here, I mentioned, I'm sorry that I'm switching up on my metaphors so much here, guys, but I mentioned from an eyesight perspective, diagnosis and prescription. I didn't mention prognosis. James also offers us a prognosis here. You guys get the difference between these three things, right? Diagnosis gives you a sense of what your problem is, like, hey, Doug, based on our tests, you've got astigmatism, all right? Prescription, of course, would be some immediate course of action to deal with the diagnosis. Here's a prescription, Doug, that is going to overcome this stigmatism, going to give you good sight. But a prognosis is something different. It's more of an expectation of what the future is going to look like. Right? They're telling you this is what you can expect for the long haul. So, for instance, if you're coming back, if you're diagnosed with macular degeneration, you go in, you may get that diagnosis in the early stages. Maybe your central vision is still working okay. You're reading books, you're driving, et cetera, et cetera. But sadly, if you've got severe macular degeneration, what they tend to call wet macular degeneration, then your prognosis is not good. You may hear, hey, there's coming a day when you're going to lose that central vision that you've got. You can count on that. That's what you can expect for the future. But as it relates to us, though, as it relates to us in the gospel, we're offered a far better prognosis, right? Our expectations for the future are bright with the Father of Heavenly Lights. And it ought to toughen us up and enhance our threshold for perseverance in the face of troubles and temptations. And here's the prognosis, in case you're wondering. Here's the prognosis. Here's what we can expect. We can count on the stability of God. He's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, is what we're told. We can count on that. His fatherly generosity and light will persist even when ours fails. He will remain single-minded and stable even when our affections go haywire and crumble under pressure. Because the reality is, we're not tough, okay? Apart from him, we're not tempered. I thought I was tough. I really did, you know, when I got on that paddleboard. I thought I was tough. I thought I would stay dry. I was sure I'd stay dry, but I fell in the water. Under the right, talking about temptation, under the right set of circumstances, we are all weak. Under the right circumstances, we will all find ourselves out at sea and up to neck in water. But get this, Jesus is stable. This is a prognosis. Jesus, this is what we can expect for the future. Jesus is stable. He's a firm foundation. He's the rock that we're meant to build our lives upon. If we build our lives upon him, here's the prognosis. We will stand, is what the gospel promises us. We will stand, we'll overcome, and knowing that, we'll do something in our lives. We can actually, when we actually see clearly, we can actually, when we can see the horizon, when we can fix our sights on the goal that will inevitably result in us coming home to him, it will cause us to be undeterred. This is where the tempering comes in, the toughness. It will cause us, knowing that, will cause us to be undeterred by all the obstacles that stand in our way. It will toughen us up. It will make us those who fight a fierce fight in the face of troubles and temptations and all the ways that they threaten to undo us. And not only that, we're almost done here, by the way. Not only that, but one day we're promised that our struggles, our fights with troubles and temptations will cease. They'll come to a definitive end. That's the prognosis of the gospel. I realize a lot of this probably sounds similar to what I was sharing with us last week, because these things are just so tied so closely together. In fact, I'm going to end off the same way that I ended off last week, because as I was looking at this, I was just like, these verses from Hebrews chapter 12 are just so rich and applicable to what we're talking about here. So let me read this and then I'm going to pray. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author, the pioneer, and perfecter of our faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him. Look at him. Get an understanding of him. Get a good view of him. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Father, we thank you that though our central vision is such a mess, that you offer us 20/20 vision in Jesus. And God, like me, we forget where we left our glasses so much at the time, when all the while they're just resting on top of our heads. God, I pray that you would continually bless us with a sure and accurate and beautiful view of all that you are and who you are to us and for us in the Lord Jesus Christ. And we pray that his name would continue to be high and lifted up in this service today. In his name we pray, amen.